Welcome, friends of the Libra Solutions Network. My name is Gabriel, and my goal is to inspire people to take an active role in building a better digital future. In this episode, I'm having a conversation with Shadow from the Simplified Privacy Project. I've enjoyed their podcast and educational content. One can see they are absolutely willing to walk the walk when it comes to decentralization, but there are always fine details to dig into. I'm grateful to Shadow for the opportunity to learn from their experiences as an organization trying to launch a freedom tech enterprise from the ground up. I have no commercial relationship with Simplified Privacy, and as such, had the chance to ask some tougher questions. What Shadow and I absolutely agree on is that both the big picture and the fine details matter. Hopefully, you'll learn a great deal from our conversation. How are you, Shadow?
All right, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And so you run the Simplified Privacy Project, and I'm really looking forward to this opportunity to learn about you and your project, but more importantly, what are kind of the guiding ideas behind it? What is Simplified Privacy? I've seen you have a lot of educational materials, some videos, and some products. What is this whole initiative?
Right, great question. Awesome to be here. And so Simplified Privacy is an organization focused on education, community, helping people learn about all these different technologies. So the main differentiator between traditional company and an organization like ours is that we're promoting a lot of open source software and various solutions that don't necessarily have anything to do with our particular products. So it's more about, in general, getting people on Libre solutions and things that improve their lives in general. And so then where there are shortfalls in existing solutions, that's where we come in.
One of the things I like a lot about your project that I've seen is that you do try to walk the walk on decentralization. You know, you show off Nostr, you show off how to even use things that maybe people haven't even heard of, like SimpleX for their chats and those kind of things, where I certainly have my own, let's just say, spicy takes on various different tools in the general decentralization space. I do like that your team does seem willing to really just try them out and put it into practice. Because how are we going to know whether these things are actual solutions without, well, trying them, seeing where they go? And so it is really nice to see that. I'm curious, what is the motivation for not only doing those things, but your project as a whole?
Right. So I was reading a lot of political books, and the problem with doing political stuff is that often you are the minority. So even though, you know, you may know that, let's say, some particular war or some particular economic way, law, it may not be the right thing. At the end of the day, if you're the minority voting bloc, you really can't do much about it. So I view this as purely through our actions of us creating these type of decentralized communities and having businesses and helping people to do pretty much all aspects of their lives, can we transition to this more free system? And one of the big issues is that if you're doing something that is going against the status quo, if you're doing it in like a particular location, they can just shut it down. While as if there are no locations, like you're doing something like on Nostr or Arweave, or you gave the example of SimpleX and Session and some of these tools that have no location per se, we're creating our own laws in society and way of doing things outside of traditional systems that give the individual much more freedom.
I mean, this is something I actually directly wanted us to touch on today, because one of the things I find fascinating about the challenges in the digital space when it comes to these tools and trying to achieve what you describe there is that many people are talking right now about Palantir. There's a hot button issue with the deals they've made with the government and the way they're, you know, really enhancing their powers over people's actual lives, not just their digital lives anymore. And the sad fact of the matter is that even here in Canada, where I'm located, we are having bills where now digital infrastructure providers, such as your ISPs and other even websites, may be mandated by government to put various, you know, backdoors or snooping devices or whatever systems the government decides needs to be in place. And to be honest, we've had a long history of this. I'm sure, you know, many of us in this space got interested because of the Snowden leaks. Oh, shoot, how do we actually have privacy online? But I do think when it comes to strategy, there are some serious trade-offs. And what I'd like to kind of have your thoughts on is that if you ask someone, what do, you know, Signal, Tor, and many of these other, let's just say more mainstream privacy tools have in common, I would say they have kind of a safety in numbers approach, where in the guise of protecting you against metadata, which is a serious issue, that was a big thing discussed in the Snowden leaks, the problem is you're all kind of putting all your eggs in one basket. And so I see your approach to many of these things is by having a preference for tools that don't take that approach. What do you think is the trade-off between centralization and metadata protection?
There's a number of ways that things can be structured. You can have a fully decentralized system like an Arweave or a Nostr, and then the question becomes, what are the trade-offs compared to normal usability and how things are structured? You could have a system where people self-host their own servers, and then you have other different types of trade-offs, like how technical is this person? Is there severe censorship in the country that they're self-hosting? And then you have services where they're completely centralized, but they offer a little bit more freedom. Like, for example, Signal has built-in encryption. So it's still, though, a service you're completely dependent on. And then it's up to that service if they're going to keep the system free, keep it accessible, not censor people, and things of that nature. So there are different trade-offs with all of these things. I don't know if any of these solutions are to the point where that's the only solution we should be using. Like, there are people who think that Nostr should be everywhere and it should be on every web app and it should be basically replacing the need for these other tools. And I disagree with that. I think it's a good tool for what it does. But all of these things used in balance is the easiest way to get people, in my opinion, off of the traditional tools.
Well, one of the drums I beat in my writing is I personally don't believe there's one tool for everybody. And one of the things I see that happens a lot is when we really dig down into these issues that we're trying to solve, fundamentally, nothing is perfect. There is barely any real technical solution that exists nowadays that is bulletproof for basically what everybody wants out of things. Like, for instance, the go-to question is, someone's like, I'm using Tor, am I anonymous? And the answer is usually, it depends, or not really, because the question is, what are you actually doing? And to me, I feel very strongly about how we need independent digital infrastructure. You know, everybody recognizes, or at least a vast majority of people recognize, big tech has its issues. And now we're seeing governments and the UN trying to really problem reaction solution this into, oh, we need public digital infrastructure, which to me is just a way of saying we're going to have more consolidation. It's just more localized consolidation, which, hey, may have some advantages. But the fact of the matter is that I think there is a really not that much capacity for independent digital infrastructure, but also independent technical skills and, you know, validation and all these things, where, like, I think it's very difficult in the privacy space, or even the general internet freedom space, or even the broader freedom discussions that are out there. Not many people are interested in retaining and building up capacity for digital resistance. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are as far as a group of people trying to run a business in this space. What are the unique challenges you've kind of taken on by trying to do this in, well, at least as authentically as you can?
Yeah, so there are a number of challenges with doing it as authentically as you can. So one of them is trust in legal systems. As far as people sending cryptocurrency to some like stranger that they don't even know. So to try and solve that challenge, as an organization, we pledged with XMR Bazaar, which basically is a new legal system where if we have a customer with a PGP signature and they didn't get the product, whether it's a phone or they felt that they didn't get the full service, they can dispute with the arbitrator and get Monero from our cryptocurrency deposit. And this actually applies to even people using Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies. It doesn't matter per se what the transactional currency is, as long as they have still the access to that same legal infrastructure. And so the advantage of this is it actually creates even more trust than traditional legal systems. Because with traditional legal systems, let's say I wanted to sue you or something, I would have to like go to the jurisdiction that you're located in. I would have to have a court case, which could go on for some long period of time. It's like I'd have to read all this complex stuff. With this type of system, the terms of service of the actual contract, that is the law. So it's, did you fulfill the agreement? And then you could have a very fast arbitration. So under our system that we agreed to, it's 2 weeks. So we have to answer within 2 weeks. Otherwise, people can press against our deposit. So this has helped a lot to provide transparency in this type of system. Also, using encryption-based tools so that it's clear that we are the author or we are the creator of something, right? So tools like Nostr, it's clear that our organization created something, or using tools like PGP, it's clear that a particular receipt is genuine. So this whole idea of encryption as identity, where we're not anonymous. It's not, I'm just sending money to random people on the internet. But you are positively contributing to society. And so probably one of the biggest differences between this and an actual, you know, dark web market on Tor where they're selling, let's say, drugs, is those type of things are completely illegal. And so if it's at all associated with you, that's obviously bad. And so everybody's completely anonymous, which makes you, yes, but under both situations, you have a public encryption key. But the person who is doing that kind of, you know, dark web market thing, they have to completely sever their activity, their work from the public key. And that's really not possible for the vast majority of goods and services. So in my view, complete anonymity shouldn't even really be the goal. The goal should be having control over the system, whether that's from a censorship aspect, whether that's from a privacy aspect of like how many customers you have, what is that customer data? But like, I'm using my real voice to talk to you right now. So it's not that big a deal because I'm doing technology. I'm just talking about technology. So it's not, it doesn't require complete anonymity of knowing nothing about me. It's instead, all right, well, what has this guy done? You know, what's the track record this has had and that type of thing, right? So it's, in my view, it's not about like, oh my God, we're all using Tor and nobody knows who anybody is. It's instead having accountability and creating this new parallel system.
Yeah, and it is interesting to me how you've kind of drawn, let's just say, a middle ground between the, let's say, establishment commerce, where it's like you got to sign up to this site, use some disgusting KYC stable coin or whatever the newfangled direction will be for those, and then everything's either public or at least accessible by corporations, whereas there's the other side, you know, the complete other side where you're saying it's like you've got these dark net markets where the sellers are anonymous. It's really hard to have trust. It's very hard to, like you say, have that accountability. And so you've identified a middle ground where it's like you can have a presence, but you don't need to rely on these consolidated or legalized systems as a whole. I imagine that trying to carve out in that space has some benefits. For instance, I have taken a look at some of the stuff you're doing, and Open Bazaar as an entity does seem interesting. But what are the unique challenges posed by that alone? Is it just that your customers have no idea what they're interacting with, or is it other kind of more technical issues that come up in that scenario?
Well, so one of the big challenges is the influencers in the privacy and freedom tech space. So a lot of these people, they make money off, well, everybody makes money off of how many customers you have. So somebody who's in the privacy and freedom tech space, or even the broader political space, they're motivated to primarily be on big tech platforms, you know, Twitter, YouTube, etc., because that's where all the people are. And so they're making all of this money, some of it in fiat, maybe some in crypto, and they're highly motivated to stay there. And the more people are on the big tech tyranny platform, the more benefit you get. So the more Twitter followers you have, the more you're retweeted, the more you're able to spread content. And same thing with YouTube. You know, the more people watching that video on YouTube, the more it's going to show up in the SEO, assuming you're thinking Google actually does SEO, but let's pretend that they are. So the more you're doing the big tech platform, the more benefit you get, which keeps people on there, and they're actually motivated to funnel regular traffic they get to stay on those platforms. So an example of this might be, let's say, TechLore, who's very big on YouTube, but he has almost no Noster following. And he didn't really promote it at all on his big tech things. And so a lot of these influencers, I'm not just singling out TechLore. I'm saying in general, there's a huge amount of this where a lot of these influencers sort of achieve, unfortunately, the opposite of what they set out to do. So they set out to educate people on freedom technology, but they end up keeping people trapped in those horrible big tech platforms because they're financially motivated to do so. And so one of the challenges of an organization like ours is I wish this were not the case, but I unfortunately have to challenge these people and basically say that these new technologies are the freedom. And if you're not promoting them, you're not living up to that hype. And the end user is not maybe able to make some of these decisions on their own. So people are saying to me, all right, if your products are so good, how come, you know, these various influencers aren't talking about it? And I'm trying to explain to them that those various groups, they may be either literally paid by traditional VPNs, they may be financially motivated to stay on those platforms. And, you know, everybody knows about the censorship from big tech and the government. That's not even news. But what is not often discussed is this silent censorship from the influencers themselves, because they don't want to spend the time and energy to these new things, and they want to keep their following, their power, their, you know, all these benefits of staying within that big tech system. And I've seen a lot of people talk the talk where they're like, all right, these are the alternatives we got to get people on, but they don't walk it. And so they'll post like one time on that thing, and then they'll never check it out again. Right? I'm sure you've seen that. And it unfortunately keeps people trapped.
No, I know exactly what you mean. And I think it's a genuinely open question whether the idea of reaching out to the most accessible public audience to convert them to freedom tech, I think it's worth reassessing whether that actually works or whether it's actually true. Because like you say, there are ways where it's like, for instance, I talked to James Corbett lately, who, when he was banned from YouTube, very few people in his quite large audience actually went to his own website that he was talking about day in, day out, CorbettReport.com. And it's tragic because I think, you know, as bad as that is, that was like without, you know, too much additional problems. But now YouTube is removing any kind of discussions about Freedom Tech. Jeff Geerling got his video about Jellyfin removed. There's even more stuff. Mental Outlaw did a video about some various Freedom Tech being considered harmful. Oh, yeah, it was ad blockers, which is, I guess, not shocking considering it's counter to their business model. But I think the ability for people who are inside that panopticon to escape it, I think that door, if it's not closed, it's closing. And a big part of this is Luke Smith did a fantastic video lately talking about how even if you oppose to the assumptions of a system, say you're in academia, say you're in big tech, by living in it, you're already letting it influence you. And you described very well about how that creates the incentives. You have creators who are subsidized or financed by VPN companies, or I would say even just general, the structure of the system you're using. For instance, if you're on Substack, like I am, you're beholden to Stripe on some level. And so if you're not casting a wide net and trying other things, it's very easy to get complacent, even if you are genuinely trying. And as somebody who's kind of been wrestling with that myself, it's not entirely obvious what the best thing to do, because there's this problem I call the feedback trap, which is, for instance, most of my readers over RSS, I have no idea how many they are. It could be one person checking in a month. It could be hundreds a day because of the nature that there isn't this kind of analytics and surveillance attached to these technologies. And Freedom Tech has this in spades. You're not going to see, business proof. You're not going to be able to go to an investor and say, hey, look at all the views I'm getting, because you honestly don't even know. It could be a lot. It could be very little. It could be nothing. You could be screaming into the void and not even know it. And so I think it is very important that the independent web, people trying to go into Freedom Tech and try to make Freedom Tech the place to be, these are things we have to wrestle with. And so I do agree with you that there is a lot of sketchiness when it comes to, I would say, the advertising industrial influencer complex fundamentally. But what do you think are the biggest compromises made in this space? Again, maybe you do or don't want to name particular names, but fundamentally, what are the compromises you see that are made that are, let's just say, counterproductive to people's actual freedom?
As far as influencers or the solutions themselves?
I would say the solutions, because there's a lot of meat in that particular direction.
Each of the solutions has its own pros and cons. I think that people are in general very isolated in their thinking, and they think that if only everybody did this one solution, that would be the answer, when maybe a mix of technologies is really the answer. So like a great example would be the Monero crowd has almost like a mental illness where they think that just if they use Monero, that's all they got to do and they're anonymous and private. Meanwhile, they're using browsers that are leaking who they are from browser fingerprinting. Like, for example, Kraken is on Cloudflare, and then they go to a website that accepts Monero, but they're using the same browser that they did KYC on Kraken on to get the Monero. And it's like you're defeating the privacy because you're focused only on this one thing. And these Monero guys are on Twitter, they're on Reddit, they're on YouTube. They're like completely missing the boat on all these other technologies. And I'm trying to tell people about, you know, let's say Noster, just as one example. And they're like, oh, well, that's all like Bitcoin people on there. Okay, well, those people on the Bitcoin thing, they have their own just my one thing, narrow focus. So they're going, oh, if just everybody used Noster for everything and Bitcoin for everything, then it would be totally free. But a lot of these people are using custodial Bitcoin wallets. And so Noster has you cryptographically sign for your speech, but a custodial Bitcoin wallet is the opposite. You're giving right up the custody, the private key of the funds. So it's like, what good is your word if I don't even know if you could pay, right? So these people are just only focused on their one solution. And very often it becomes because they're financially motivated to do that one thing, right? So that's what I said at the beginning. This is the difference between an organization and a company. It's like, yeah, I have a product, But we're how many minutes into this conversation? I ain't even mentioned my product yet. There's just so much stuff that I have to teach you. And, you know, one of the biggest criticisms people have of what we're doing is that it's focused on Linux. And at least at the moment, we're only accepting cryptocurrency. We're going to expand to have a peer-to-peer market type stuff. But at the moment, somebody has to have Linux and crypto to even begin interacting with our product. And so people are telling me, oh, well, you know, that's a small audience. Do I really feel that the anonymity set is large enough? And, you know, there's all of these people trying to attack us. But the point is I'm not trying to build scaffolding on like the mud. You know, you have to have certain basic freedoms to begin with. And then that's, you know, at the OS level, at the, let's say, legal philosophical level, like we're trying to do with these PGP contracts, at the currency level with the crypto, this certain base level freedoms that now we're building upon. And that the problem with the just my one thing is not only is the person not using these other tools, not recommending them, but it's like they have to push their thing at the cost of everything else. It's like, right, I just have to get this forward. And so I'm willing to, you know, let's say, register a traditional business, use big tech marketing to reach just the most people. I just need, if everybody just did my one thing, but they don't realize that that one thing by itself is not like that liberating. If everybody used Monero, but did so on traditional big tech, it wouldn't matter because they would see all the traffic of who your customers are. You know, if your website is a WordPress website with Google Analytics, what does it matter if it's Monero, if you're using like your Gmail? I literally see, I'm not going to name names, but I've literally seen multiple Monero influencers using a Gmail as the contact method. This is like, how do you not see that that's an issue?
It's fascinating to me because I actually was listening in on an X Space recently by a bunch of crypto people. And I think you really hit the nail on the head as far as there is a bigger picture you have to keep in mind when you're trying to, well, do anything in this space. And it's hard because that takes a lot of time to understand fundamentally. And so one of the reasons I've been afraid of selling products myself is the fact that it's like, I know the bar is incredibly high. And a big part of this is Naomi Brockwell was in that space, and she was saying that it's all well and good to do your best on a regular internet OPSEC level, you know, making sure you're blocking ads, making sure you're not using surveillance technology, you know, doing everything you can to stay private. But she points out that even with Monero, even with, you know, the theoretically perfect private cryptocurrency that you're using, it's still a record of transactions, which itself could be hacked or broken or, you know, analyzed by AI, whole other rants about AI in the future, probably. But the thing is fundamentally, the risks related to transactions online are so much higher. And so I agree with you that if you're seeing people who are not taking, let's just say, at least the big picture, or at least taking what they're focusing on so seriously, it does make it hard to want to engage at that level. And I think some of it's well-intentioned. I think, you know, you say, you know, people want to say, oh, if we just all do this, you know, everything will be fixed. But I think the argument from their side is that, oh, if everybody just used, you know, whatever tool we're talking about, wouldn't we have raised the floor? Wouldn't things have been significantly better? And it's funny to me because I saw a video lately by The Hated One where he says, actually, you should be using a VPN. And he's talking about how various VPNs are now in a very adversarial relationship with the network infrastructure itself, because sophisticated traffic analysis tools can now de-identify users because of how consolidated all this tech stuff is. Like, for instance, if 80% of the web is behind Cloudflare, I'm sure that's a lowball estimate. At some point, if somebody has access to Cloudflare's traffic, and that would be them themselves or other entities, they can correlate data no matter what sophisticated systems you're using. And so my biggest concern when it comes to this discussion and this space broadly is that a lot of people have unrealistic expectations of, I want to be perfectly anonymous, but I also want to use big tech infrastructure. I still want to be on this hostile cyberspace, as I call it. And to me, my preference has always been, we need to build up our own digital infrastructure. infrastructure. We need to build up our own online spaces that are not built in this kind of Jenga tower of hostility and surveillance. I guess when it comes to the kind of feedback you'll get from customers is that if we do acknowledge all of this is so incredibly difficult, what can you actually provide a user? And what expectations should they have? And what limitations can they expect of the products?
Yeah, fair enough. So, I mean, you pretty much handed me the exact thing I was going to bring up anyway, which is the centralization of a lot of these CDNs. Cloudflare definitely being one of them. There are, you know, other big hosts like Amazon AWS, Google's cloud service. And a lot of these guys are seeing the absolute bulk of the traffic. They're not only are they measuring the speed, packet sizes, and doing that type of analysis, but also the browser fingerprinting. The same companies are seeing you on all these different sites. They're seeing how quickly you pull from the same servers. A lot of the sites themselves are on the same, like Cloudflare's a CDN, right? So the actual website is hosted on a particular provider. But if your VPN is the same company as the website itself behind Cloudflare, Cloudflare is seeing both ends of that. And then the data center is seeing both ends of that particular provider. So a huge problem is that these VPNs, a lot of these Freedom Tech sites are just completely ignorant of these issues. And they are suffering the just my one thing. And that's why they're trying to get the product through as fast as they can. So people always want to criticize Simplify Privacy that we took like 3 years to get a product to the market. Well, that's the learning curve of you got to solve each of these issues. And so you mentioned earlier, you know, like what can people do with the big tech thing? And so I don't advocate people to just like completely go cold turkey and boycott all these things. You can still obviously use these services, but you want to do so in a more conscious way. And so we're building up two apps, two systems, you know, one for the regular internet where people are using the tools they already are, but in a more free way. And then we're trying to build up this system with Arweave where we have an app that streamlines the process of getting somebody's website onto Arweave for like a podcast or for a blog, things of that nature. And so this makes it so if you want to have a website on the regular internet, you can, but it could streamline this to make the process easier. And then as far as using the regular internet, we have this app Hydravail that provides all these browser fingerprint profiles, routes each one through a different IP address, routes each one with a different browser, and creates an environment similar to a virtual machine that realistically fools the website into thinking that's your screen size, that's your real time zone, things of that nature, matches the time zone to the IP address, and it allows you to isolate these pieces of your life, makes it much easier for someone that doesn't want to use Tor browser all the time. You know, Tor browser has issues in the fact that it only is able to work by blocking tons of types of JavaScript. And so many of these websites use those types of JavaScript, not to mention Tor IPs are blocked quite often. So Hydravail makes it much easier for somebody to be anonymous or to, technically you're not anonymous in the sense that once you use a particular fingerprint, you are now associating that account with that, with that fingerprint profile. But the goal here is not every time you load a website, you're a random person. It's that you're that account. Cause once you log into an account, you're no longer anonymous, right? So Tor's motto is every time I load a website, I'm anonymous and I'm a nothing. Well, then when you start doing anything, like you allow a certain type of JavaScript because it has to load, you're now opening the door for the fingerprinting, right? Well, so instead of that, we're saying it provides a pre-made profile. You know, you make it, but this identity that now every time you log into the site, you're that same identity, but it's not tied to the other identity.
Well, I think it's a big concern when it comes to fingerprinting being the tip of the iceberg, because, for instance, lately Meta was caught doing a particularly nasty thing where if you were using their mobile apps would open a port on your device. And that way, whenever you were browsing the internet that was connected to Meta's infrastructure, so if they have tracking pixels and other stuff, the idea basically was that Facebook could or Meta could track you through your own device's applications, no matter what site you were on. And this is a particularly gnarly thing because it means that it doesn't really matter what precautions you were taking against browser fingerprinting, because they're doing it under the hood. They're doing it at the system level. And I think there is kind of an lack of recognition about just how nasty these surveillance companies can get when it comes to being creative. You know, we only know about stuff because security researchers find it. They're not going to outright tell us all the nasty things they're doing with our devices. And so I do think there is a lack of understanding about how hostile the modern web really is. You have all these companies that are basically built off getting every bit of data they can just to sell it or repackage it or use it to manipulate people. And it's a very hostile environment. That's where I guess I lean closer to the side that, like, yeah, we probably should limit interaction as much as possible. And just in terms of, like, what you're offering, because, yeah, the fingerprinting protection is nice. This setup is very specific. But who's the ideal customer for what you're providing? Is this for somebody who just wants to browse Facebook? Is this for somebody who's trying to run a darknet market? Like, what is, because you mentioned that requiring Linux itself is a big filter of who you're potentially offering this for. What is somebody actually trying to get out of using your services?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is this is not for a dark web person, because the dark web would be using Tor onions with no JavaScript. So really the ideal person is someone who wants to transition their life to more freedom respecting solutions, but they also still want to dip their toes in, you know, I mean, you said Facebook, but yeah, somebody could browse Facebook in this isolated environment. Somebody could have a YouTube account. Somebody can use all of these services and keep it isolated in a contained way where they are getting more privacy and security that's preventing the type of things you talked about with Facebook tracking across all of these different sites. Yes, there are these issues where the majority of people are on operating systems, you know, whether it's mobile or whether it's Windows or Apple, where the operating system itself is spying on them, or it's allowing the vendor to do all this nasty stuff. So by having people on Linux to begin with, it's a good starting point. But, you know, even within Linux, there are issues and things that apps that you download or sites you use can do. So that's why it's important to have this easy availability of privacy when people need it, so the person doesn't have to read all these books and know all this stuff to be able to easily access it. Now, does everybody who is using Facebook, am I expecting all those people to come over? Obviously not. I think that this is basically for the people who are smart enough to realize that they got to get off this stuff, but yet practical enough to want these types of tools. And, you know, more and more we're saying the word big tech here, but more and more services and things are being closed off. So, like, yes, an example of that would be Facebook, like, blocking stuff to the Fediverse. You know, they're trying to close off, or people were before using YouTube front ends, they were using Reddit front ends to not have to interact with the service directly to still be able to just, you know, look at content, even like Twitter front ends, some of them are breaking down. So it's kind of forcing people to interact directly with these types of services, and some of them are forcing logins. And because of the vast amount of information on there, it's basically got people stuck where they just go, oh, do I want to sacrifice so much, you know, not just content, but interaction with these types of people, whether it's marketing their business. So a lot of people are basically saying, is it privacy or, you know, sit in the woods? And so that's where this is coming in. Hydravail makes it so much easier for the person to get a little bit of the best of both worlds, right? But the thing is I don't want to just only be doing Hydravail, because if I'm only doing Hydravail, I'm basically just like kind of perpetuating the problem, right? So I'm saying you want to use these corrupt systems, and I'm going to sell you a way to do that. Yeah, that's fine. That's good to have that option. But at the same time, I'm also promoting these alternatives to get people off the tyranny systems. So we have Arweb, which is the app, like I mentioned, with Arweave. But there's a lot of stuff you could do with Arweave. There's a lot of stuff that could be done with Noster. So we're also doing these other systems, right? So it's promoting both.
Yeah, what I do find fascinating about what you've been doing so far is you do play around with more technologies than I've even touched myself. You know, for instance, I'm aware of Arweave. I'm aware of Noster. I simply use Noster because it's bridged to the Fediverse, which is where I spend most of my time. But I do have a short section of, well, hardball questions to ask you, because fundamentally, if I was writing about your products and your ecosystem here, there are some pointed questions I would want to understand, because I do hold things to a high bar. And so one of the things I want you to kind of opine on, to the degree you're comfortable with, is how independent is your own infrastructure for this project really?
Well, so we're running right now during the let's call it beta, right?
Okay.
Technically, the word beta means a freeze of features, which we're not doing. We're introducing new features constantly. But let's still use the word beta. During this beta transition, Simplify Privacy as an organization is running all the VPN servers. We're also running the billing server, and it has a built-in distribution for all these browsers. Could expand in the future to things such as chat apps. So somebody could have, let's say, two Signal windows open with different IPs and phone numbers, and that would realistically, you know, let's say, fool the Signal servers that you have different accounts. But for right now, browsers. So right now, during the beta, Simplify Privacy is running them all. Our plan is to transition this to a decentralized system where various operators who are known, like I'm talking about influencers, you know, in the future, potentially you could one run, but various influencers who are in the political space, the just freedom tech space in general, would be running these nodes, and there would be some form of encryption identity. Whether that is Noster or Arweave, yet to be determined, but the person would publicly post on one of these encryption as identity networks the public WireGuard key and say, yo, I'm running a Hydravail node. Here's the WireGuard key. And so now when the end user connects to that server, there's encryption verification that, okay, yeah, that's the same WireGuard key he posted, and things are good to go. And then because there's two layers to Hydravail, there's a system-wide and a browser only, it would provide anonymity similar to Tor, but different in the ways I'm describing. But instead of having random Tor nodes, you just connect to a node. Who knows if it's the government? Who knows if it's actually the charity that's supposed to be running it? Instead, the user picks among the choices that they know, right? So it's not about like I'm the dictator and I'm deciding who's in the network. It's about the communities presenting, okay, yeah, this person wants to join. All right, yeah, let's reach out to them and see if they want to do it. And at the end of the day, it's who does the end user trust, right? So we're providing the infrastructure for this type of technology, this type of community. But at the end of the day, it's up to the end user to decide who they trust, what ways they want to use it, and we're taking the feedback from the users to guide further development.
So what you've described is you have a model that you are trying to present as a proof of concept that may decentralize in the future through various means. Could somebody say, look at your projects now and replicate your setup, probably find fixes or even compete with you based off what you're building already? Or is that more kept close to the chest?
Well, so there's three aspects to what we're doing. There's the end client, which is on the user's device. There's the WireGuard nodes, and then there's the billing server, right? So right now, the client on the end user's device is completely open source. It's in Python. So anybody, it's a GPL, so it's copyleft. Anybody is able to modify that. I can't change it or affect what they're doing. So technically they could compete with me. I wouldn't advise against it because we're making so little money. So you'd be crazy to do that. But so that aspect's done. The WireGuard nodes themselves, that'll be opened up at some point in the future once we progress further in the decentralization. And then the actual billing server, as far as the browsers go, I was thinking we'd probably put that on Arweave eventually. The advantage of doing it on Arweave is that right now the user has to authenticate. They have to buy a subscription to be able to download a browser. And so that prevents somebody from trying to attack us by just downloading browsers over and over again, completely unauthenticated. But there is a privacy risk with the person we're seeing, like what browsers you're downloading. I mean, we're not, the software doesn't have the ability to log that right now. But if we put it on Arweave, which is the plan for the future, you'd be able to completely unauthenticated download it and then just use it. If the person, right now, it's set up where the person has to buy a VPN subscription to be able to use it. In the future, the plan is to get the stuff on Arweave, and then at that point, we would be able to have like right now, it's open source and it's copyleft, but you do have to pay to use it. And so once we achieve the full browser distribution without directly connecting to our servers, we would be able to have a freemium model where it's free and open source. Anybody can modify the code. Anybody could use it for free. And then we'd have those premium services of the VPN traffic and, you know, potentially other things. We also have a proxy service. So if the person wants to do Tor to a SOX 5 proxy, they can do that. And so, you know, there's various improvements and things coming down the pipeline. We're doing them as fast as we can. You know, it's overwhelming. And just to touch on one of the other points kind of made earlier, by narrowly focusing on just having a Windows client at first and allowing people to use third-party Android apps, I mean, there's not really that much advantage to a lot of these VPN apps and just the free and open source Android apps. So people can plug our WireGuard configs right in there and get, you know, essentially all the features of the regular ones. But by focusing on this Linux client, it creates a lower threshold financially of what we have to do to function as an organization. And so that, like if we have venture capitalists, if we have, you know,
is there any plan for that?
We have all this stuff. It creates pressure on the organization to make choices,
right?
Like, do we have a Twitter account? Do we, you know what I mean? If the customer is anybody under the sun, it's like, oh man, I really gotta have all this tyranny tech. But if the customer is only a Linux, it's like, okay, well, where are the Linux and crypto people at, right?
And I guess part of this is I like that you're planning to open up many of these things, though there is a serious question about long-term maintainability, in the sense that if you come up with this model that works and then people can decentralize, either you somehow need to get value out of that to keep investing and making these things better, or there's some kind of scheme where they have to be the ones, you know, the community broadly has to be able to maintain.
I mean, definitely there would be people who are going to run nodes, they would have to give a percent of the revenue to the organization for development. So it's not like I'm the government taxing you. You're agreeing to the nodes are agreeing to be part of the network, and then as part of that agreement, they're getting a percent of the revenue. And at first, that percentage is going to be higher tilted towards our organization. And as this progresses, like let's say in the future we get an Android app, then we'd be able to kick more of that revenue back to the WireGuard nodes. So a lot of people print their own crypto,
right?
And the problem with the printing their own crypto is that then anybody can run it. And so I'm looking to make them. I'm looking to make it a commodity for the end user. The end user is anonymous as a commodity, but the node itself, who is that guy? I want the customer to pick among choice and be able to evaluate among choices that they trust. And so, yeah, could we do a proof of stake crypto where we're like,
I was going to bring that up. Yeah.
Yeah, we could do that, but, I don't really, right now, that's for me not a priority. So I'm not saying that's evil. I'm just saying it's not a priority for me right now. For me, the priority is getting the features, getting getting these, you know, all the things I just described to improve the end customer's life. Cause really you got to think about it. The customer, they're using my vision is that people use cryptos already. So you already have a Monero wallet. You already have even, let's say, a Bitcoin wallet. You use that crypto that you already got. Right now, I don't see printing my own proof of stake as solving that much.
Oh, I lean towards the side that proof of stake is kind of an evil model in the sense that what that would allow the people who control the controlling stake in that system to do is then they could basically censor operators. It's like, oh, you don't like that this guy is participating in this ecosystem. That leads to questions to how decentralized it really is. As far as I'm concerned, proof of stake is basically a Ponzi scheme with extra steps in general. I mean, there's always arguments you can make here nor there. And to be fair, that's one of my criticisms of Arweave. I believe Arweave is a proof of stake. And I understand.
So let me jump in right there. So Arweave has two cryptos. One of them is the base level storage on the network. That is proof of work, but it's called proof of useful work, where they have to prove they have the files. So I have no issue with that.
Yeah.
Zero. I think it's a great system.
Provided
I
it like works.
Arweave as a protocol. So now that's the base protocol. Now you have a second team, a whole different group of people that doesn't need approval from the first group. So anybody could run this second group. I could make my own competing gateways if I wanted to. So this second group, they have a proof of stake coin for the gateways. You don't have to use their gateways. So they control their own gateways, but you don't have to use them. I could make my own. Now, am I going to do that right now? I don't see. That's not a priority for me right now. So everything should be thought of as how much time and energy to how much freedom do they get. So yes, a proof of stake can censor who's in the network. But under a system that I'm proposing that we're going to do for Hydravale, we can censor, you know, we're choosing who's allowed to be a WireGuard operator, a node operator. So we could censor. Our policy is if the community, which I'm defining here as people on Noster, people who use these messengers in our chat rooms, if they're approaching us and going, hey, we want to have this person run a node, and there's a decent case that they're have a decent following, that they abide by similar philosophical principles, we're open to having them. We're not about censorship. But you know, if Google approached me and said, we want to run them, my job is I'm trying to filter that out. So I am censoring, but I'm censoring groups that I view as malicious. And the big problem is that if these huge companies, just who's running it is not the only factor. It's also like, what is the infrastructure that's on?
Precisely.
So like, for example, Ethereum is decentralized, but they're all on Amazon's AWS. So is it really because Amazon can pull the plug? Or they can, you know, reroute, they could control the hardware so they could push through transactions that are, you know, at the end of the day, the hardware owner is the real owner.
Yeah. So there was an interesting story where I believe it was Jabber.ru, some XMPP server for Russians, basically got man in the middle by their VPS provider. So it is very.
Yeah, it was pets nurse.
Yeah. And so it is a serious concern in this space. So I guess to really hit that issue on the head, I'm curious. So whether somebody is, say, using this system through you or one of your selected providers, what is the trade-off between those two? And how much are they trusting you? How much are they trusting the provider? How does that all work?
Yeah, these are great questions. So Hydravail purposely does not connect to the internet when it starts up. And it already has in place where once you buy a subscription to that one WireGuard node, right now it's set to $1 in Monero or you know, Bitcoin Lightning or Litecoin. So the person buys this $1 subscription, they download a browser, and that's the end of their interaction with the billing server. And from then on, when they hit connect, as long as that subscription is valid and as long as they have the browser in that folder on their computer, it will directly connect to the WireGuard node. And at that point, the billing server is no longer involved. So under ideal situation, the person is only interacting with Simplified Privacy when they first create the account. And now from then on, they're interacting with the nodes they choose. So they choose one provider for system-wide. They choose another provider for the different browsers. And they could even have a third one if you want to be like Tor and have it on your router as well. And the person might say, well, why don't I just use Tor then? And again, Tor has, first of all, it has the issue of you don't know who these nodes are. Is it the government or not? Second, you have the issue that Tor is essentially socialism, where the government funds it, and it's because it's free, people use the network as much as possible, and that makes it slow. It's also slow because of the way Tor is indifferent to locations. So let's say somebody is standing in the US, they may connect to a German node, and then they may go right back to the US, going back and forth over the same ocean cables that are tapped. You know, think about it. The government's tapping the ocean cables. And what a coincidence, the government also made Tor that goes back and forth indifferently through those same ocean cables they're tapping.
I mean, I'll say it's worth pointing out that I think one of the things that causes so much confusion with Tor specifically is that Tor is two things. People see it as either one or the other, but it's really both. Tor does provide some kind of anonymization system that in theory allows people to browse the internet anonymously through various means, but it's also a censorship mitigation technology. That is why it routes all the way through the world. And the challenge is if you are using Tor for a particular reason, say either anonymity or circumvention, what ends up happening is that there will always be trade-offs the project has to make, either in one category or another. So if you really need one category, if you really need, say, censorship circumvention, Tor may work really well for you. If you really need anonymity, maybe you have to consider how you're using it. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because most of Tor's anonymity benefit is just safety in numbers. There's X many Tor users on the internet, et cetera, et cetera. But as you say, there are some fine details really worth paying attention to depending on what you're trying to get out of it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not saying don't route to other countries. What I'm saying is Tor is indifferent to locations. Precisely. So I connect to Tor. Maybe I'm going to Australia. Maybe I'm going to the US. Maybe I'm going to Europe. It picks this random bouncing around. I'm saying doing multiple hops or layers is fine, but I advocate for people to do it in the country closest to them as the first one, and then go and cross in a pack. So you're not going alone across the ocean cables, or, you know, lots of these, what's called the backbone of the internet. Each country calls it a different thing. But a lot of these huge data centers with these huge providers are the ones that are being the most monitored, where there are these easy choke points to get all this information. So I'm not opposed to routing to other countries. I'm in fact encouraging it. I'm just encouraging people to move through the infrastructure as the infrastructure moves farther away from you, as opposed to randomly bouncing around. And not only are there privacy issues with Tor, but there's this speed issue. People go, oh, well, it's onion routed, and that's why it's slow. Well, also there's the fact that it's moving randomly around. It's indifferent to the locations, which has undeniable speed effects, plus the socialism. So there's a lot of issues. And then the Tor browser itself not working on so many sites, like not only just Tor browser because they're blocking JavaScript, but then even just Firefox in general, is most developers don't focus on Firefox. Like, I love Arweave, right? I'm a fan of Arweave, but Arweave's own app to change your domain name, you got to use a Chromium-based browser, because they didn't have the money, time, foresight to get it to work properly on Firefox. I mean, there's 100 examples of that. And, you know, we were talking about Monero earlier, but a ton of these Monero things use Cloudflare, and some of them even block Tor. So you go Monero Town is a forum on the Fediverse. They were blocking Tor for a while because they were getting DDoSed. Fine, but that's the problem with free Tor. Free. Well, then people can DDoS, and so then they restrict the behavior. I'm saying pay a dollar. So if you pay a dollar, now we're the DDoS police. The nodes can cancel subscriptions involved in DDoS.
But to kind of circle back on what you're doing specifically, you mentioned various upgrades. You've talked about things you have planned for the future. Given that you're kind of in what you described as a beta state, what are the logical next steps, investments you either would like to or need to make as, say, you get more support? Say people start buying this, even if it's not necessarily for them now, what are the upgrades you need to kind of make this viable, or are serious things you need to do that are you're trying to put into practice that you need more support to do?
Yeah, so one of the biggest challenges is people are looking at us like, who the fuck are you guys, right? So we're saying, yo, we got the best thing on earth, right? We worked our asses off. Look at all these problems it solves. Look at all this logical stuff we're saying. Look at all this open source code. You can look at all the code. You can verify for yourself all these things. You know, like I told you earlier, oh, well, it only connects to the WireGuard node, not to the billing server again. Oh, but look, you can verify that in Wireshark. And the person goes, what is Wireshark?
Right.
You know, oh, I just started using Linux. Oh, I don't know how to read Python. Right. So the fact that I'm saying all this stuff, and then it's like I'm boycotting all these traditional systems. Right. So it's like, oh, you're not on Twitter. Oh, you're not on LinkedIn. Oh, you don't have a bank account. It's like, all right, you know, who is this guy? Who, what, like, so the end user is going like, man, how do I evaluate if any of this is legit, right? Because we're just, you know, we're like basically an unauthorized, unaccredited, because I'm boycotting all those systems. And so then when you in the earlier part of this conversation, we talked about how all these privacy influencers, they're stuck in their old ways because they're making money off the being influencers on Twitter, YouTube, whatever. So their stubbornness to evaluate our thing is the biggest roadblock right now. So it's not like, oh, we only accept the crypto. Oh, we only use Linux. That's the easy things for people to shame on. The biggest obstacle is getting people to even evaluate and look at this thing because they're so blunted in the ways that they're doing it now. And there's conflict of interest with a lot of them. Like I'm trying to not name particular names to be respectful as I can and to not burn bridges. You know, this is about educating people and improving people's lives, not about, you know, throwing rocks at individuals. I hope it doesn't get to the point where it's throwing rocks.
Well, I would say one of the biggest limitations I can see, you know, moving forward is the fact that, like, I don't know, like, I only looked around briefly, but do you have currently any independent audits of how your stuff is run? Does it match what you say it's, you know, how it's run? And also on the cryptography side, have you had cryptographers look at your stuff? And are there any plans for that in the future as far as independent audits, independent verification goes?
Yeah, so that's a great, great question. So first, I think we need to take a step back and say, what is this? So it's two layers. So the first layer is just regular WireGuard. So it's running the same, like on Linux, it's running the same WireGuard quick command that all other the VPN apps are using. So there's no cryptographic difference. And in fact, I would say it's a commodity in the sense that they're not really having to trust us to do very much. I mean, we're using the standard security practices, but at the end of the day, it's really just running WireGuard on the person's system wide. So the need for an audit is very low. And if we were to get an audit, the cost would be very low due to the unoriginality of that system-wide layer one. So now the question is, we've created this customized layer two environment, and it withstands basic testing. Like you do, DNS leaks tests, and you do these types of tests, and you go, all right, this works as it appears to, but is there some kind of security flaw where the website, right, let's say, is running some malicious JavaScript that's trying to break out of the browser and to get at the base level system. So for that type of situation, we have to ask, what is the bar, right? Like the bar here is not our solution is a replacement for virtual machines to run malicious breakout software. The bar is, does this fool the website from a fingerprinting perspective? Because if the person is running a whole new virtual machine, like QEMU, Cubes, that whole
right
group of virtual machines, they need the whole operating system taking up space on their computer, which makes it not realistic for the average person to have these different profiles. So we're trying to say what is the real issue here, which we're trying to solve, which is the fingerprinting and having these different IPs and routing it in a private way. We're not trying to solve browser breakout per se. There are some advantages from a browser breakout perspective. We are putting this in bubble wrap, which is similar to what Tor is doing. Tor also uses bubble wrap. We use it in different ways. We are creating a second graphical environment so it doesn't share. The browser can't see your other apps the way it could on a just plain vanilla desktop. So there are advantages, but it's not to the point where it's a full-blown virtual machine and it's able to resist breakout like a virtual machine could compared to a regular system. So at the end of the day, you have to look at these audits from a cost-benefit perspective. So if you say, okay, the cost of an audit would be, let's say, $30,000 to $40,000 from a reputable firm, and we're charging a dollar for WireGuard subscriptions, right?
You have to say,
what is the benefit to doing it versus what is the cost? And so from my eyes right now, the cost of burdening the organization and taking away the money we would have for development just to have somebody repeat the same information that I just told you, which is that it offers some benefit to breakout, but not full benefit to breakout like a virtual machine would, when full breakout is not even who I'm targeting. I view it as not the priority. I'm not saying I'm never going to do it. I'm not saying I don't want to do it. I'm saying given the real world of our resources right now today, it is not, it's just simply not the first thing in line. So at the end of the day, if the person is that worried about breakout, they should be using a virtual machine. And if the person is that concerned that we're retarded and the browser itself is going to leak, it's the layer two. So this is a second. This is like a condom on top of your armor. So if the second layer is not good, then why would you go and use a different provider that only has the layer one, that is just doing the system wide? That's a commodity. It's the exact same WireGuard quick up command. So if you step like, yes, to say, oh, we don't have an external audit. Oh, we don't have bank accounts. We're shady. Okay. Yeah. I hear that. But if you step back and look, what is the goal here? The goal is these isolated browser fingerprints. The goal is not breakout. I'm doing the dark web. There's no way using Facebook in Hydravail is less secure and anonymous than just doing it on your system with the same browser, right? Let's say you're using Brave browser. Using Brave browser on your regular host system, to say that the CIA Facebook is going to do a browser breakout of Brave to your host Linux system with WireGuard Quick, versus doing it in Hydravail where it's a second layer and it's got its own, bubble wrap to prevent it from getting to the host file system. It's got the isolated display. Like there are advantages, but there's just no logical reason that you would go to the worst just having the layer one, right? You hear what I'm saying?
No, I do. And I think a big part of this and where it gets dicey is just the fact that it's hard to know for most people what to expect, because if they aren't very knowledgeable of these technologies and even the risks themselves, because it's very nebulous, especially for less technical users, it's hard for them to know what to expect, and it's hard for them to know what's even reasonable. And I see over and over again that there's a lot of criticism dished out because people want perfection, but perfection requires your own behavior. Your own behavior will factor in to whether a particular tool is perfect for you or not, which is why I think it's really important for people to be very critical about what they're choosing to use rather than just accepting something because they saw it in an interview. You know, that would be the principal example of like, no, that's not the reason you jump into something. You have to think about what you actually want to get out of the product, service, whatever, and why you're actually engaging with it. And I only specifically brought up audits A, because I know independent audits are a high strain on any project. That's why the typical way of doing the kind of thing you would kind of try to do is you get some kind of government grant, and then you use that to create a nonprofit, and then you start building these tools.
The government grant route, I absolutely hate. And a lot of my competitors are using the government grant route. And it's honestly unfair, because then the adversary has compromised what the project is doing, and it enables people to do projects that are not that good, that then get to progress to the point where they're able to just be known because they have all this money. And so but what I'm saying is Hydravail at this point is not going to make it unless we have voluntary customers and investors. And so I really dislike these groups. Again, I'm not naming names to throw rocks and to make it hostile, but there are freedom tech projects where the goal is to resist the government, but the government is funding them through some kind of grant. And I am definitely absolutely opposed to that. We will never do a government grant. But I'm not opposed to the audits. Under an ideal situation, some of these WireGuard operators have coding experience. Maybe they are, like they work in InfoSec, they have some kind of audit experience, maybe even actual literal, they have a business of doing audits. There are a couple of guys in the Monero space that I actually know doing this. And maybe we have some kind of deal where they give it a look, they test it out, they maybe not every line for line of it, but they test it out and then they get to run a node and they're part of it and they get the revenue as payment. So I'm in favor of these type of like community interactive, freedom oriented solutions, and absolutely not the government grants to do bank accounts, to do, just for somebody to look at WireGuard quick up. And that's the other point, is that we're using existing technologies on the cryptography side. It's WireGuard for the base layer, level one. And then in the browser, it's their choice of a SOX 5 proxy or WireGuard as a proxy, which we didn't create. So wire proxy already existed. So it's encrypting it as a SOX 5 proxy, so it doesn't require root access. But these technologies already existed before I breathed air on the project. Mm. And so that takes some of the strain off that we're not rolling our own crypto. These are well-established protocols and ways of things of doing things.
Yeah. I'll double down on that just to say that, like, one of the things that you're definitely aware of that I want at least the public to be aware of is just the fact that you can take these open source solutions and build something on top of it to make it more usable, more convenient, straightforward, whatever the system is. And a lot of companies do this. In fact, some of the most extreme data breaches, there was the MoveIt breach, which was because the tool that was being sold to governments and corporations was built on top of SSH and, moving files across that. There are open source tools for doing this. And I do find it kind of fascinating that in many of these serious data breaches, for instance, the US government had a Signal breach that was not because they were using Signal, but they were using, I forget what it's called, but there was a tool they were using to sync from Signal. And so there are a lot of threats with even just taking these solutions kind of off the shelf, and how you manage them matters. And so I guess to kind of get to what I said earlier, I believe that's why many of the, say, influencers who may not want to touch this, it's like they want a independent report to say, okay, I know this is at least safe enough that I won't get flat for talking about it. But the fact of the matter, as you say, is that if you do expect that before talking to anybody, then guess what? You're never going to hear from anybody without X amount of capital to start a project. We do, in my opinion, if we do want a diversity of solutions, if we do want people to experiment, if we do want people to build truly new and revolutionary things, we need to figure out how we foster that from the ground up. And to me, an important part of this is having conversations, engaging with these decentralized protocols such as Noster, the Fediverse, which I'm on, and various other systems, because it's so important that if we want the game to change, we have to try to change the game. It's a very hard thing for people to engage with, because I don't see many people in this space who see the long-term plan. They see, an optimistic vision of how we can change things. And that's really what I've been trying to present in my work. And what I like about how you talk about these problems is you at least see the long-term vision of, like, what does it take to go from where we are to where we would like to be? And I just kind of curious if you have any, like, kind of closing thoughts where you'd want to leave us. Because I've kind of been a little hard on the hardball questions, but I'm curious, what general would you like to say as some closing thoughts?
Yeah, I actually, these are fair questions to me. I don't actually think they're that hardball. I think that ultimately whatever it is going to require education from the end user. It's going to require education from these influencers and for people to actually take action and adopt them, not only for my own apps, but also all the tools mentioned here and other ones we didn't even get to. And so with all of these things, security and privacy and audits and all of these types of things, they are absolutely important. But also we have to acknowledge like what are sort of established things and ways of doing things, right? So like, for example, our website right now sells WireGuard configs for somebody to insert into a pre-existing Android app, right? So we didn't make the Android app and we didn't make the WireGuard protocol. So in my eyes, paying a single dollar to have that audited is a complete waste because the audit can't even verify that the server isn't logging, let's say, you know. So there's pre-existing tools and things, agreed ways of doing things that people should be willing to accept, even if it isn't audited, right? That we build upon. And yes, is it possible that the WireGuard protocol has some kind of flaw in it that it can be hacked? Absolutely. That is a possibility. But that same possibility exists whether I have an audit for it or not.
True.
So.
No, I hear you. And that's definitely true. I do think there's a lot of important discussions related to like all the different things we've touched on, whether it's decentralization, how the media landscape kind of influences all this. If people can't really develop things on their own, if they can't get support to build something sustainable out of it, unless it stays a small hobby project, which, hey, some people are fine with. But then if everything's just going to be small hobby projects, you can only expect so much. And I think, and this is completely off topic, but I think it's kind of relevant to the streams we're holding together. And I'd be curious to get your thoughts on this. Because there is a lot of drama in open source right now. And a lot of it is because corporations have huge control in open source. And that's where maybe a lot of the kinds of people who would criticize WireGuard may actually bring in some of those criticisms of like, well, big open source is kind of a thing. And so I'm curious because my perspective is we need to figure out how to build these systems from the ground up. We need to create a groundswell of support, training, all this stuff that like right now is handled by academia and corporations, which if we want to decentralize, we'll have to break away from those systems one way or another. So I'm curious on your thoughts as far as trying to run a business in this space. How do you think you can balance authenticity versus what you're actually trying to deliver?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one, right? So when you're talking about a certain system, how technical of an answer do you want me to give here? Because there are some frameworks, right? So for the end listener who doesn't have programming experience, there are frameworks, like let's say Flutter, that let you build things, but then you're reliant on Google to do that library, right? And so that exists for a lot of these platforms. And then you have not only the actual programming itself, but then you have the distribution of it. Like, let's say, are you dependent on Flatpak? Are you dependent on Google? Are you dependent? You know, a lot of these things, they have baked into it distribution. And if you're not in that easily distributed way, it's like, oh, well, how are people going to find you if you're not in the Google App Store and you're an Android app, right? And if F-Droid itself says, you know, beat it. And so that gets, again, back into this problem of centralization. And there's only one way to solve this centralization problem, which is to use these decentralized solutions. But what does that mean? It means trusting these people who are not part of the system. So there's no way around having to trust organizations, companies that are newer, that don't have the certificate from the king, but are showing you open source things that can be verified, that do have authenticity. And yes, that means the end user has to do more research the end user has to learn more, but that's the goal. That's why I started this conversation with, we're an educational organization.
Yeah, you do have a lot of blogs and even videos, I noticed, about all these topics at a pretty granular level, which is nice to see. And I agree with you that whatever direction we want to take things into, it is important that we're honestly discussing things at a deeper level. You know, I will say a great fact of the matter is that we're having this conversation without you, you know, sponsoring me or there being a commercial relationship. So I can't ask questions that I know you wouldn't see in a YouTube interview of some VPN CEO, or I've seen in the crypto space. You know, you do see these kind of palm greasing relationships. So, and so I am very grateful that we were able to have a candid discussion and I'm able to hold, you know, you to the kind of standard I would want to hold anything else. And I'm glad you were so candid with me and gave me the opportunity to learn from you. I think this is a great conversation and I look forward to seeing how things go. And I would love to hear from people how they think these problems should be handled, because there are so many different threads we can pull from this. So thank you so much for joining me. I hope you have an excellent one, and thanks everyone for listening.